evening. Hello. Welcome to our restaurant. My name is Marius. I'm your waiter for today. Welcome. So today, if you'd like, I can introduce you to our specials. We prepare our specials menu based on what's fresh. So today we have grilled garlic and rosemary marinated lamb chops. Or if you would like, we can try a traditional beef brisket.
Oh, lovely.
This song's called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant.
I highly recommend you the Dublin Cuddle. You will love it.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
It's a simple fact of life that all animals must consume some form of food in order to survive. Some eat it, some drink it, some absorb it, all require it. Most have evolved complex digestive systems to extract the maximum amount of nutrition from their preferred fuel supply. Enzymes break it down, stomach acids dissolve it, and chemical processes convert it into the very building blocks of life itself. Well, they do to at least some of it. But what about the leftovers? The parts which the body cannot use, and which must therefore somehow be discarded. Excrement, feces, turds, dung, droppings, poo. Call it what you like. The waste products which animals, including us humans, excrete are an inescapable part of life. The sheer quantity produced around the globe each day beggars belief. Entire ecosystems depend on it. A natural fertilizer that recycles nutrients and which is vital for the continuation of food chains. The fertilizing properties of poo have long been known and have been harnessed by man almost since the dawn of agriculture. Animal excrement is widely used across Ireland to this very day to fertilize land. And farmers generally use yet another word to describe it, slurry.
Now, Terry, we'll go spread this load of slurry something with.
Oh my God, the smell of that is unreal.
Biologist Terry Flanagan is fascinated by this subject.
Oh, healthy.
Healthy, oh crikey.
Healthy.
Can we stand back on this side of it a little bit because...
Oh. I can see it now, it's flown out.
Yeah, I can see it there.
It'd be splashing.
Can we move
out
back just a little bit more? Because
don't
really
get on the clothes, don't get on the clothes. She won't love you if you go home selling like that.
He paid a visit to North County Dublin based farmer Lawrence Ward to learn more about this brown gold. Another term to add to the list.
How can you get used to that smell?
You become immune to it over the years. It is very strong, I agree with that, but we're kind of used to that. Out farming, but if you had the city people out living out here, they're saying, oh my God, what's that smell, or who's spreading that, or what you doing? But yeah, no, it does smell. There's a good strong smell off that.
Oh, really, there
so
is.
So it is. Healthy, but smell though. Healthy. When you think of the nutrients going into the ground of that smell.
Well, I look at the grass, even though it has been very, very dry, your grass is lovely, looking lovely there.
Yeah, it's coming along now, coming along.
And I know that's with some of the water that maybe,
well,
because you're near
rain
a river,
yeah,
but
yeah,
and the little bit of rain we've had lately, but whew, it must have something to do with that slurry as well.
So, and that's we have to be very careful that we don't allow it flow off down into the rivers. Like, we're very protective of the environment in that way, that we manage it well and manage it right. But there is a smell off that.
Isn't there? Okay, Mum, we move back a little bit. That is incredible.
Poo is disgusting.
If you were to ask a 7-year-old what poo is, they'd give you a pretty detailed answer, wouldn't they?
It looks like brown, and it's probably really squishy, but not sweaty. Slime, slime, slime. And it's sometimes in little bits.
We get the idea. But from a scientific, biological perspective, just how would you define it? Dr. Patrick Orr is a paleobiologist at the School of Earth Sciences in University College Dublin.
Who's everything that the organism is finished with, that it's made use of, that it is then brought through its body, and then it is packaged up into a neat parcel and it's delivered it. And of course, the actual contents are going to vary depending on what the animal is, diet that it has, for example. But in general, it's going to be remnants of organic matter that it hasn't been able to process. It's going to be absolutely stuffed full of bacteria, and of course that's one of the major implications for health, and also one of the ways in which then we can actually interpret poo in the archaeological and geological records.
And then why do we find it so disgusting?
Yeah, I mean, it's a phenomenally useful product. You think of it in terms of all the uses we put it to. But I guess it's the association with waste, it's the association with disease. It goes back to whole issues in history in terms of sanitation and the outbreak of disease. So it's this connotation I think it has of something that's poisonous and dirty.
Yeah, because we just don't want to be near it.
No, we want to keep a long distance away from it. We tend to just flush it away and hope for the best and send it on its way.
Now, we're here in the geology department in UCD, and we look at all of the fossils. We look at the amniotes, the trilobites, all of those. And you use those to look back in time, but you can also use poo to look back in time.
Oh, absolutely, both through the archaeological and the geological records. It's a phenomenally useful, and I would argue, actually undervalued resource in understanding the evolution of ecosystems. So if you're an archaeologist, you might be interested in disaggregating relatively modern recent poos in order to look for things such as eggs of tapeworms, for example, and looking at infestations in populations. If you're in the geological record, what you tend to find, your poos are in the form of what we call coprolites, and that's its way of actually getting from a relatively soft, squishy object into the geological record. It's quite literally turned to stone. So if you go to, you know, the National Museum, or you go to any sort of geology department, somewhere they will have this twisted lump of mineral, and that is a poo.
So from an archaeological point of view, if you find poo that's very, very old, and if you look through it, you could possibly find some of the remnants of the disease-causing organism that caused major infections many, many years ago.
Absolutely. You can actually find the eggs. The eggs are often a very resistant stage in the life cycle of many of these infectious organisms, and the eggs preserve very, very well inside poo for things such as tapeworms, for example.
So really we can look back in time by looking through our poo?
Absolutely. And you can extend that even back from the archaeological record into the geological record, right back through Earth history.
Poo has been around for millions upon millions of years. Indeed, for as long as there have been animals on Earth. Most poo disappears fairly quickly, however. But where would you go to see really old poo? Nigel Monaghan, curator of the Natural History Museum in Dublin.
When we deal with poo in a natural history museum, and as a paleontologist, I'm dealing with very old poo, and we have a fancy name for it. It's coprolites, which simply means dung from the ancient Greek, kopros, and lithos is stone. So when you see light or lithos or anything, that always means it's a stony version of something. And paleontologists realized that some of the lumps they were finding in the bedrock, along with the bones and all the other exciting things that they were really looking for, were actually fossilized poo, because they found tiny fragments of fish scales and other things in them, in the marine rocks, and they realized this must be the remains of somebody's meal. And the shapes in particular, and the sizes to a degree, of that fossil poo can often tell us a lot about the animals that they might belong to. And so can the contents, because that's basically the mushed up food that can't be fully digested.
Well, when I think of fossils, I think of things like amniotes and trilobites and things like that. That's the most common thing. I'd never have thought of fossil poo.
Well, fossil poo was first nailed, if you really want to think of it that way, in the 1840s, when people were looking for ichthyosaurs in English Lias age, that's early Jurassic age rocks around the coastline, and people were making amazing discoveries. famous Mary Anning was discovering ichthyosaurs. And there was a man called William Buckland, who was a dean and a fascinating character, and he was obsessed and fascinated with fossils and where they might have come from and what did they mean. And he had a relatively naive amateur eye, which meant that he wasn't coming along with all the professional baggage of, it must be this because the books told me so. So when you're finding something new, the books telling you so is not the way to go, because that's somebody else's older ideas. And he looked really closely at these things, and he said, I've looked closely at them and I've studied at them, and they've got fragments of fish scales and other things of other animals that were around at the time, and they're in a little lump, and sometimes it's a spiral, and it looks like a dog poo for all the world, but it's hard as the local rock is. So that must be the droppings of animals. And in fact, the Geological Curators Group newsletter to this day is called Coprolite, because it's droppings from the Geological Curators Group. Coprolites are fascinating little time capsules, because they can tell us a lot about what the animals were eating. Because if you eat a fish in the wild, you don't eat it with a knife and fork and leave the bony bits on the plate. You're eating the whole thing. Your digestive system isn't necessarily going to get rid of everything. It's not going to have the time and the acids and everything else to break down all the particles of a fish. So you'll find the scales, and sometimes you can actually match the scales in a coprolite to an actual species of fish and say, I know this species of fish was being eaten by ichthyosaurs in the Jurassic period 200 million years ago, and they were leaving the droppings on the seafloor as the evidence.
Just where do we find these coprolites, and what can be gleaned from studying them?
If you want to find fossil poo, the internet is your friend, of course, as it always is. But if you're a paleontologist, you can go to places where people have fit before, and frequently the environmental conditions can be just right to preserve them well, and there can be layers of the seafloor that weren't readily disturbed, didn't have a high rate of sediment buildup, so fossil poo is quite common in those layers, but you could still be hacking around in the bedrock for a very long time.
Now, what animals leave the most poo?
I suppose you have to work out who's the biggest here, because it's very much about that in terms of volume. You want to go for whales. And nowadays, we work with the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. We collect genetic tissue samples from stranded whales and dolphins around the Irish coast, and they're available for researchers to do DNA work. But before people started doing that, one of the ways of finding out what large whales were doing was chasing them with a net and waiting for frequently pinkish poo, because it'd be full of crustaceans, is a major food source, the krill of the larger whales, and catching that floating material to find out what are they eating, but also to get examples of the whale's own DNA. When you've got large live whales, you can't get that close, and they don't stay still to let you take a blood sample. So what are you gonna do? You chase the poo.
Incredible. Now, you have some examples of fossilized poo here. Can we have a look at them?
Now, this little box here has a little package inside, and I use the term loosely. It's a little plastic bag, and it contains, for me, one of the most valuable examples of poo in the National Museum of Ireland collections, because this chalky white lump that's not as big as my thumb is actually from a hyena that lived in County Cork about 40,000 years ago.
Now, I never thought hyenas lived in Ireland.
A lot of people don't realise that during the Ice Age in Ireland, there were quite a lot of animals that aren't around today. They might be familiar with the giant deer, the Irish elk, with those huge antlers, because people see those in stately homes and museums in Ireland, and they're quite famous.
And here in the Natural History Museum, of course.
And especially in the Natural History Museum, we have a large collection of giant deer with their antlers, and they tend to dominate the storyline. But we also have bones of woolly mammoth on display, and some of the other animals like brown bear that were around during the Ice Age. But one of the least known, least famous, perhaps, animals of the Irish Ice Age is the spotted hyena. Now, that's the type of hyena you find in Africa, south of the Sahara. It's the one that you tend to see hanging around lion kills in films of the Serengeti. Mm-hmm. And hyenas were present across most of Europe in the cooler phases of the Ice Age. And they had a number of key prey items. They would particularly follow large herds of woolly rhinoceros. And woolly rhinoceros is completely extinct. It's closely related to the rhinos that you'd see in Africa today. We don't think, as far as we know, that we ever had woolly rhinos in Ireland, but we did have woolly mammoths. And we even have hyena teeth marks on woolly mammoth bone from a particular cave in County Cork, which is the only site where hyenas have ever turned up.
Now, this particular sample, as you said, it's quite small, it's almost spherical, and it's very clear in colour, kind of an almost white colour. What can you tell from it?
When you put these under the microscope, the hyena coprolites, those droppings from a 40,000-year-old story back in North County Cork, there's fragments of bone that are quite clearly identifiable. You can see that it is bone, you can see the little striations, the grooves and the pores that you'd see on the surface of a fresh piece of bone from any mammal today. You can also see tiny little pieces of hair. And I would love when technology gets to the point that we might be able to get the DNA from that bone and from that hair and see, is that woolly mammoth or is it woolly rhinoceros? And they're sufficiently different animals in terms of their DNA that even a small fragment might be enough to point the finger at what hyenas were eating. We know that they chewed and gnawed on woolly mammoth bone because we have those in the museum collections. Nobody in Ireland's ever found a bone or a tooth of a woolly rhinoceros. And I would love to think that the evidence might be sitting there in front of us for over 100 years, waiting for the technology to catch up.
And how long will it be before that technology catches up?
DNA technology, a bit like the iPhone in your pocket or whatever, it's accelerating at an incredible pace. So the ability to take very tiny samples and amplify those to the level that they can be measured and enough detail to be present to see the fragment of the DNA jigsaw to be able to say that little fragment can only be from something in the rhinoceros family. That would be brilliant.
So this is a very specialised piece of poo here.
This is my favourite piece of poo in the museum collection.
Not all poops are created equal. Excrement differs from species to species. Biologists regularly examine animal droppings so that they can identify the different species that live in a particular area, which makes sense. After all, poo tends to stay put long after the creature responsible for its creation has moved on. Paolo Fiscardi is zoology curator at the Natural History Museum in Dublin.
Well, it varies a lot depending on diet, obviously, and the size of the animal. So something like an elephant will have a huge amount of poo, and it will tend to be quite coarse. It's quite rough because of their diet. They will eat pretty much whole trees, small trees, so there's an awful lot of fibre in there. So you end up with quite a kind of a bit like horse poo, with you can see lots of the kind of vegetation that's inside the poo, because a horse doesn't break it all down. It's not able to break it all down like something like a cow would do. So a cow has a much more complex system in its stomachs to break down the vegetation more fully. So that's why they chew cud. So they start breaking down the grass they eat, and then they kind of belch it back up again, and then they chew on it some more to break it down, and they swallow it again, and it goes to a system of stomachs which act like fermentation chambers where bacteria do most of the work, breaking down those complex plant molecules and making them more digestible.
So that they can get as much of the goodness out of the food that they've eaten as possible.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about, getting as much out as you possibly can.
Now, rabbits, on the other hand, they have a different strategy. So instead of chewing the cud, bringing it back up, they actually poo out and then they eat it.
Absolutely, it's called crefication. So it's this, we think of it as kind of disgusting process, but actually it's quite an important process. So there are two sorts of rabbit poo. When you kind of, if you're out for a walk or something and you'll see them lying around, the little kind of round shiny ones, which look quite plump, that's the first stage of the process. That's the first poo, as it were. And that's where it's moist and there's a lot of bacterial action there, breaking down some of those complex plant fibres to make them more digestible when they get eaten the second time. The second poos will be very dry. They look more like raisins. And those are the ones where they've been through the whole system, the rabbit system again. And that's where they will have extracted the rest of those nutrients. And so they tend to be drier and they tend to be a lot less nutrient rich.
Are there many animals that behave like rabbits then?
And there are a few which will do that. And you'll actually find that there are other animals which would find something like kind of the rabbit poo, the first stage poos, like dogs even will do this. They'll eat them when they find them because they still have a lot of nutrient in them. So it's not that unusual for things to eat their own poo.
Now, Terry, have a look up at those cliffs. See all that white? That's guano.
Tara Adcock is an ornithologist working with Birdwatch Ireland on marine bird conservation near Howth in County Dublin, specifically on the island of Ireland's Eye, an important seabird breeding colony. She told Terry about the guano wars.
That's guano.
That is.
I thought that was bird droppings.
You're exactly right. That is what it is. Guano is bird droppings.
Now, there's tons of it here on the island.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it's not actually useful for fertilising or anything like that because of the weather. You want dry weather for fertiliser, such as down in Peru,
right,
where you have the guano islands.
So I presume then on those islands in Peru, there's very little rain.
Yeah, there's very, very little rain, which means that the guano can build up over years. In fact, in the 1840s, it was 60 metres deep in places.
What's that? 60 metres or 200 feet in old language?
Yeah, in old language, it's 200 feet.
God. And then what would happen is you'd have the sailors, they'd come out and they'd ship it back to the States.
Exactly. And what happened was there's guano mania. It was considered brown gold because it was worth more than gold at one stage.
Isn't that incredible?
It's insane. It's brilliant. Such a humble kind of product, but worth so much.
And why is it worth so much?
So there's two reasons. One of the reasons was that it's a really good fertiliser. You have to remember that America and Europe were industrialising at this point, so their populations were growing and
this
they needed...
This is about the 1840s
1840s,
or so.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So they needed more fertiliser to grow more vegetables and plants, etc. More food for their populations. So that's why it became really important, but it's also really important for explosives.
It may seem hard to believe now, but nations actually went to war over guano.
Now, just go back to the fertiliser. It was really important because it was so concentrated, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah, it was very, very concentrated in minerals such as nitrates, phosphates and potassium, which right. You get from a seabird diet, not from your average bird diet. It has to be a seabird diet because of the diet that they have.
Right, so collecting it from the pigeons on the end of the road, no good.
No, no good at all.
And where we are here now, we're on Ireland's Eye.
Yeah.
And we're surrounded by birds.
We are. We have gulls, which you can hear behind us, yeah, in the background. We also have cormorants, gannets, shags, kittiwakes. We had guillemots and razorbills and puffins, and so they left about 2 weeks ago to go back out to sea. So it's a unique hotspot for seabirds.
And there would be lots of bird droppings on the island, but as you said, it is of no benefit to us.
Exactly. Unfortunately, it isn't. So that's why we had to go so far afield in the 1840s, 50s and 60s to get it.
Because they couldn't keep up with natural fertiliser.
Exactly.
That's why they needed something different.
Exactly, exactly. As populations are expanding, they just needed more fertiliser.
So it's hard to think that something, as we look up at it here on this cliff, that's so white and, in one sense, yeah, dirty because yeah, we don't want it.
Yeah.
It was really a very important commodity at one stage, only, what, 100, 150 years ago.
Exactly, exactly. It was brown gold, like I was saying. It was worth more than gold.
Really?
Yeah, and it actually led to wars, which you wouldn't think that bird poo could lead to war, but it did. So the Chincha Islands War, when Spain took over the Chincha Islands.
Imagine going to war over bird poo.
It seems insane, doesn't it? But that's how important it was. That's how valuable it was.
Recognized the value of poo for the last few centuries, but it has been extremely important to plants for much longer than that. Dr. Matthew Jebb, director of the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin.
Here we are in front of a big collection of cotoneasters, and at this time of year you can see they're covered in bright red berries, which stand out strikingly against the green background. And indeed, the colour red is very attractive to birds, and that's precisely what these plants are doing. They're advertising their red berries to be eaten by birds. The birds then fly to another tree. They may fly up to a mile or two before the seed finally passes out of the back end of the bird, and lo and behold, that plant has achieved the ability of moving its baby seeds, the next generation, an enormous distance. So it's a very elegant way in which plants that can't move, they're rooted to the spot, are able to send their children out into the world.
But it's also a very expensive way because they have to use up a huge amount of energy to create this fruit. The fruit is of no benefit to the plant, it's only of benefit to the bird. And the colouring, all of those fancy colourings that have to be added into it, the phaeophytons and whatever all those reds are, all just to get that bird to come along and take that seed.
As the old saying goes, there's no such thing as a free lunch, but what the plant is exchanging it for is the ability to move.
Now, these seeds, as they're passing through the digestive tract of an animal, it's not a nice place inside because there's lots of acids and lots of enzymes. Surely people would think that the seeds will be killed off.
That is what you would imagine, but actually the seed coat is fantastically resistant, not to prolonged exposure to acids and enzymes, but for the duration of the passage through the gut. The apple tree, for example, evolved in Central Asia to be dispersed by cave bears. And anyone who's bitten into an apple pip will attest to the fact that this bitter flavour suddenly fills their mouth. That's cyanide. Now, you'd have to eat hundreds of seeds to actually give yourself an injury from that amount of cyanide. However, it's enough to make it spoil what you're chewing in your mouth. And the cave bears know this, and they never quite let their teeth come together. So when eating an apple, they'll take great care to crush it and swallow it whole. And so the seeds avoid being crushed by the teeth of the bear. And we all know what bears do in the woods. And in doing so, amazingly, they spread the little apple pips around the forests.
And is it true that the seeds have a higher chance of germinating having passed through the digestive system of an animal?
A lot of seeds have an inhibitor to germination. So, for example, we take tomato plants or melon seeds. They will not germinate if they're sitting there rotting in the fruit. But once the rain has washed them clean in a compost heap or through an animal's gut, a tomato seed is stripped of all these inhibitors. So the next time it sits in a nice warm little pot of soil, it germinates straight away. So this again is designed to make sure that the fruits that fall around the base of a tree or the mother plant do not germinate until something eats them and carries them away. And thereby, they're not going to compete with mum and dad, they're going to establish new colonies.
Nature finds ingenious ways to repurpose natural materials and processes. If you have to poop, why not use that poop to your own advantage? Excrement can tell a story, and lots of animal species use it as a means of communication. Many have evolved a special anal gland to help the process along and to make their message as clear as possible. Paolo Viscardi of the Natural History Museum.
Well, an anal gland is something that carnivores have, and because they use their poo as a way of identifying who they are and where their territory is, they like to kind of add an element of smell to it beyond just what they've been eating. So when you think about the smell of poo, it's normally down to the kind of the product of bacteria which are breaking down whatever you've eaten. So that might be a very fishy smell if you're something like a seal or something that eats fish, or it could be something more kind of grassy. So cow dung has a more grassy kind of solidy smell, and the breaking down of that by bacteria is what really kind of gives it that poo smell.
And of course, things like pine martens, that they eat a lot of fruit, and they get that kind of sweety, musty kind of smell.
Yeah, and I think with something like a pine marten, a lot of that musky kind of sweeter part of the smell is partly because of the anal gland kind of adding an element of smell to the poo as well.
And why is the animal adding a smell to the poo?
Well, it's because that smell will be kind of pretty much unique to that animal. And it's a way for...
Now, to that animal or to that species?
Well, both to that species and to that animal. The thing is, we're not very nasal. We smell something and we can smell kind of obviously big differences, but we don't have a sense of smell as sensitive as something like a dog or a pine marten or an otter or any of these carnivores, which use their sense of smell quite a lot. And they use that sense of smell they use it partly to find food, but also to find mates and to identify information about their environment. So that can be things like what other individuals of the same species are around. So if you think about dogs, they'll all kind of urinate in the same place. And what they're doing is they're laying down a mark saying, I was here. And that smell of urine will be very distinctive for that particular dog, that not just the species, but the individual animal. And the same thing will happen with poo as well. So when you have something like an otters have this, you know, they're often having their poos described as smelling like Parma violets, you know, the sweets, because it's a very distinctive odour. And that's partly because, you know, although they eat fish, they also have this anal gland, which they can use to add another layer of
kind of aroma, which is more consistent, actually, kind of across the species. And for the individual animals, it's actually very distinctive as well. So they can smell it and they can tell there's another otter in the area, but they'll also be able to tell which otter it is and whether they've met them before or not. And that's kind of really useful information. That's why dogs sniff each other's bums.
And I presume, is that a male or is it a female?
Yeah, absolutely. And it will give you that level of information if you're another otter.
And if it's a female, is she in heat and maybe I should be going after her?
Absolutely. And all of that kind of information could be encapsulated in odours and smells. And it's this area where humans are, you know, we think we're quite good at smelling things. We have perfumes and we kind of notice bad smells and we use it to tell if food's gone off or if something's ripe. But actually, our noses are not very sensitive at all.
These animals, they just take it to a whole new level.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So the poo, not only is it a waste product, something to be gotten rid of, but I can use this to communicate with other animals of the species.
Absolutely. It plays a really important role, actually, in communication.
Unsavoury though it may sound, the smell of an animal's droppings can also be of great help to vets in diagnosing gastric problems or infections, especially if the animal in question is suffering from diarrhoea. Veterinary surgeon Joe Nealon from County Meath explains.
In the case of companion animals, dogs and cats, etc., it's very often possible to tell from experience the nature of the feces, of the diarrhea in particular. For example, in the case of parvovirus, the smell can be particularly pungent. But to be sure, there are proprietary tests which can be done on feces, either bacteriology. Likewise, serology can be done on animals, which will give us a definitive definition of the causative agent of diarrhea.
Because diarrhea, I'm sure, is pretty traumatic for an animal, losing all of that fluid, particularly if it's a young animal, a pup or something.
Well, an animal with severe diarrhea will dehydrate very quickly and very often will require fluid therapy in order to restore the fluid balance of the animal. That's just apart from treating the causative agent.
How dangerous is it then for the public to be handling, say, the poo of their pet?
It can be very dangerous, in particular if there's any infection in the feces, be it parasitic or bacterial. So it's very important that, and children in particular, wash their hands after handling their pets. Or indeed, if you have handled your pet on a regular basis, washing, etc., perhaps a pair of rubber gloves would be advisable. It's also very advisable to worm your animal on a regular basis. And there are proprietary brands which deal with both roundworms and tapeworms. And if an animal is wormed on a regular basis, you decrease the chances of a zoonotic infection coming from the animal to a human.
Because that parasite is effectively using the poo as a go-between to get out of one animal and to get into another animal.
Correct. The feces are the vehicle which transmits the infection from the animal to the human.
But can it work in reverse? I had better rephrase that. Can humans pass infection onto other animals? Terry put that question to Dr. Brenda McManus from the Dublin Dental Hospital at Trinity College.
That's true in some ways. We can definitely pass on certain types of fungi from humans to birds, and we have seen examples of that. For example, some of my previous research actually managed to recover isolates or types of candida from seabird excrement. Now, technically, it was recovered from the surface of ticks that were living in seagull droppings. And we were able to look at the DNA of the candida recovered from the seabird excrement and compare it to the DNA from candida recovered from humans.
Now, candida, for those who are not familiar, is a fungal infection, I think commonly called thrush.
Exactly, yeah. It's a fungus that is pretty much famous for that word, thrush. Right. Yeah.
And what effect is this going to have then?
Well, you would imagine then it can be excreted in the poop from humans.
And then birds maybe going around scavenging, picking it up.
So, yeah, we found that there was a very close genetic relationship between the candida recovered from seabird excrement and that recovered from humans. And because of that, we suspect that the isolates are being transmitted from humans to seabirds, probably because of the scavenging nature of these birds. And we have a lot of seagulls that hang around the campus in Trinity College, and they get fed very well. So you'd imagine that the food that people are eating gets contaminated with the bugs that are living, the fungal bugs that are living in people's mouths, and then go on to be passed through the gastrointestinal tract of seabirds, and then consequently come out in their poop.
So what's actually happening there then is a human is out there eating his lunch out on the bench outside, and a seagull comes along and you throw down a bit of the bread to the seagull.
But as it turns out, you're throwing more than just the bread, you're throwing whatever bugs you have living in your mouth.
We're all familiar with meat-eating plants. Think of the Venus flytrap, for example. But recently, a group of scientists discovered that there are some other plants that actually actively attract animals not to eat them, but to eat their poo. Matthew Jebb again.
Here's a lovely collection of pitcher plants from Southeast Asia. You can see the end of the leaf has turned into this thin little tendril, which then turns into a great cup full of liquid. And these have always fascinated plant growers because they eat insects. They catch and digest insects. So there's about 120 species of these pitcher plants scattered throughout Southeast Asia, merrily eating insects. But about 4 years ago, an extraordinary discovery was made on the highest mountain in Borneo, Mount Kinabalu, where people set these little cameras. We can all get these little tiny cameras nowadays that can be left to record for several days up at the top of a mountain. And it confirmed a suspicion that some of these species, four in total, that live at the tops of mountains, are actually poo-eating plants and not insect-eating plants. They have an extraordinary picture that almost resembles a little toilet. And every morning, these tree shrews and little rats come along and they lick the underside of the lid. And in doing so, they put their little feet on the edges of the bowl and they're straddling that as they're licking the surface. And they want to mark their territory. They say, this food is mine. I don't want any other tree shrews or rats muscling in here. So they produce a few droppings to scent that particular plant. They drop into the pitcher, which gradually fills up with their little droppings. And these plants are getting all of their nitrogen from the droppings of tree shrews and rats. It's an amazing discovery, only made because these little cameras could record something that otherwise, every time a human approached, these little tree shrews and rats would make themselves scarce. They'd keep quiet, they'd disappear. And it was long suspected that something was afoot here, because in these pictures, we could find a brown amorphous mass of rotting material, but no insect legs or wings or the suggestion that they were catching insects. So it is an extraordinary evolutionary change from eating insects to suddenly eating poo.
Any excuse to use that sound effect again. Now, as a rule, we humans tend to dispose of our waste in a sensible, sanitary manner. But what about our fellow members of the animal kingdom? Do any other animals use toilets like we do? Paolo Viscardi.
Latrines in nature are actually quite... they're common amongst certain animals. So if you're a herbivore that doesn't want to be found, you don't really want a latrine. Because if you have a latrine, then it means that predators will know where to find you, because you keep going back to the same place again and again and again, which is obviously a really bad idea if you are trying to avoid being eaten. Mm-hmm. You make it very easy. So predators will smell feces, and they will use that as a way of tracking where there are animals that they might feed on. So your kind of waste products can be actually a real disadvantage if you're not careful about them. Now, what's kind of the other end of the spectrum will be when you want other animals to know you're around and to basically be scared of you, or to know that they're in your territory. And that's when latrines are very common. So that tends to be large carnivores, things which are quite dominant in an ecosystem will often use latrines as a way of saying, I am here, because they smell. The badgers do this in Ireland and kind of in Europe, where there aren't many other large carnivores. So it's kind of, they can get away with it. If you go to places like the States and America, the larger carnivores will use things like latrines. So bears will often, they'll mark trees and they'll use kind of a latrine area around that as a way of marking the fact that they are in a space and that that's their territory.
Are they talking just particularly to other bears or other animals in general?
It'll be other members of the same species.
Yeah.
So badgers in particular will, you know, that's their way of saying this is our family latrine. It won't actually just be for one badger. Many badgers within the same family, because they live in family groups, will use the same latrine. But what that does is it shows that there's a large latrine there, therefore there are lots of badgers. And if you're another badger from somewhere else coming in, maybe a young male that's trying to find a new territory, if you come across a very large latrine, you will say, well, I better not hang around here because there are lots of other badgers in the area. They've got a territory here and there are too many for me to take on, so I'll go and find somewhere else to go. And it's just a way of maintaining your boundaries and your borders and basically saying, don't mess with us.
What exactly is poo made of? We know that it contains waste material that is excreted by the digestive system along with a large dose of bacteria. But what else is lurking in a stool? Dr. Patrick Orr from the School of Earth Sciences at University College Dublin.
Yeah, if you've walked past a dung heap on a hot summer day and you see that cloud of flies rising up off it, those flies, of course, and the eggs and the maggots and things like that that are associated as part of their life cycle, they're all living in and around that. And they and other organisms, worms, for example, it's not uncommon to find them preserved in archaeological settings. And what's happened there is that the organism has either fallen in or it's landed in this poo, for example. And as a result of that, then, it's literally been encased in it and turned to stone. The composition of the poo contains the necessary elements to literally replicate the organism that lands on it in minerals.
So they will be preserved in the poo. I'm thinking something like the way insects are preserved in amber.
Absolutely. In this case, rather than actually being incorporated into the amber and the original tissues preserved, remarkably what happens inside things like latrines and cesspits is that the little fly will end up preserved in minerals, because the concentration of those elements in the poo is such that it actually replaces the tissues of the fly or the maggot or whatever has landed in there. So they are quite literally turned into stone inside the mushy pit of poo.
So you can tell what insects were present maybe 50, 60, 70 million years ago just through its poo.
It's mainly used in the more recent archaeological record, though there's no reason why it shouldn't be used in deep time. And we have instances in deep time. For example, there's a very famous example of what's believed to be a tyrannosaurid coprolite. And in that, there's actually chunks of muscle that weren't digested that have now been turned into mineral, in this case, calcium phosphate.
And can you tell what that animal was?
Not what was eaten. There's too little of it left, I'm afraid. It's just fragments. So it's just muscle fragments. So I don't think anybody's had a guess at what dinner was.
It is often said that nature abhors a vacuum. Evolution finds ways for organisms to exploit virtually every ecological niche imaginable. Nothing goes to waste, not even waste itself. A prime example of this is the life of the dung beetle, or rather, dung beetles, plural. Well in excess of 7,000 different dung beetle species are known to science, presumably with many more yet to be discovered. There are almost as many species of dung beetle on Earth as there are species of bird. And they all have one thing in common. They eat poo. Where are these beetles found? And how exactly do they fit into their environment? Matthew Jebb.
This plant here is an acacia we're coming up to.
Yeah.
And indeed in Africa there are huge numbers of acacia species. They produce little green pods of seeds, very hard black seeds inside those pods. And it's almost that they're accidentally spread by animals like elephants. Elephants will pull down a whole branch of an acacia, stuff it into their mouth. They're eating the leaves, but accidentally they're also eating the fruits. And the pea pods of those acacias produce these black, hard seeds. They pass through the elephant's gut, and elephants produce prodigious quantities of dung. In fact, if there was nothing to clear up elephant dung, in no time at all, the savannah would be knee-deep in elephant dung. But if you ever go on safari and you watch browsing elephants, if you move on to the area where the elephants have just moved on, 5-10 minutes later, big, colourful beetles start to arrive. These are dung beetles. And in no time at all, hundreds of beetles are present, and they are burrowing under the dung, they're burying dung, they're laying their eggs into this dung. Some of them are moulding it into lovely little balls and rolling it away, digging a burrow and burying these balls of dung with an egg on it. The egg will hatch into a little larvae, and in 9-10 months' time, out will hatch a baby dung beetle. But inside that dung ball are the seeds of the acacia as well. So accidentally, if you like, the dung beetle is helping those seeds get a nice burial away from forest fires or savanna fires. Even with a little bit of a dung ball around it, it's damp, it's humid, it's well fertilized, and when it germinates, up it pops. So the elephant dung, by being buried by the dung beetles, is achieving the opportunity of little acacia seeds being planted ready for germination.
But nature has even more ingenious tricks up its sleeve. Some plants have actually evolved to fool dung beetles and to take advantage of their love of poop.
One of the most extraordinary plants down in the Western Cape of South Africa has achieved a trick of fooling dung beetles. This is a sedge-like plant called Arrestionaceae, and it grows in the fynbos, this very fine forest that grows on the white sandy soils of South Africa. And it produces large circular fruits, or globular fruits, that lo and behold smell of dung. And after a light rainfall and the smell is carried by the wind, dung beetles start to appear at this plant, and they assume, somebody's already made this nice dung ball, I'll roll it away and bury it, and then I'll lay an egg on it, and my baby's going to have all this opportunity. Somebody else has done the hard work of making this dung ball. In fact, it's only when the beetle has dug the burrow and it's pulled the dung ball inside that it suddenly realizes this is a seed of a plant. It's completely hard and I can't even puncture the surface to lay an egg. So the beetle walks away thinking, damn
frustrated.
It, I won't be fooled next time. But it always is, because the cue it's relying on is the smell of this lovely globular lump of a seed that looks exactly the same as a dung ball. And this is the first wonderful example in the plant world that we've discovered of a plant tricking the disperser in a truly astonishing manner. So the dung beetle has been tricked into thinking these seeds are little balls of dung. And it's working so well because this plant survives the bushfires. This habitat is prone to a lot of fires, not started by people necessarily, but even through lightning strikes. So there are regular bushfires in South Africa. These seeds, if they lay on the surface, would be incinerated. But by being buried into the damp, humid soil, they're completely protected from the fire. And this is all part of this arms race of natural selection.
And if you think that's some smart flora, there's a plant in the National Botanic Gardens that takes things to another level entirely.
We're in the palm house here, and every year we try to grow a few pots of Mimosa pudica, which is also known as the sensitive plant. It's an amazing leguminous plant, and if you touch its leaves...
Oh,
like
they all
doing
close
it,
over. They're all
it
closing
curls
over.
Up. Yeah. It's a very extraordinary reaction, and that's one of the sort of thrills of this plant, that it seems almost like an animal, the way it moves, rather than the rest of the plant world that doesn't do anything when you touch it. Now, whilst that's been long known about, it was only very recently, about 4 or 5 years ago, that a research group in Israel discovered that the roots of this plant produce an appalling smell. a sulfurous smell. So one of the jokes that's now arisen is this actually is the farting plant. Because if you disturb its roots, it has little hairs on them that release these sulfurous compounds that smell revolting. It smells exactly as though somebody has farted in the room where you're repotting these plants. It's amazing that this has gone unnoticed for so long. Usually we sow the plants on these big pots and we allow them to grow. We don't plant them on, we don't repot them. They're quite sensitive, as the name implies, to being repotted, so it's easier and safer to grow them in the final pot. So it was only because they were repotting these plants they suddenly noticed this.
And what's the advantage of the smell?
What happens is anything disturbing the roots of this plant is likely to get this appalling stench, and maybe it repels them. So any animal burrowing in the ground under this plant will be repelled by this smell, and it's very probable that this is serving an excellent way of protecting the plant from disturbance. How it's working or why it evolved is totally unknown. It's just one of these extraordinary facts. Nobody would have suspected that a plant would fart until this Israeli group discovered it by pure chance, handling a plant that we've known about for hundreds of years, but nobody observed it in that particular way.
So plants and animals have found ingenious ways to exploit poo and to turn it to their advantage. As we've already mentioned, the bacteria in our lower guts are vital to our health, and they play an extremely important role in the digestion of our food.
One of the ways you get benefit from food is by relying on bacterial activity in your gut to release chemicals from the food that you can't release yourself. Things like fruit and fiber and vegetables, which we all know are important for a healthy diet and for health in general, the chemicals that you require from those dietary ingredients are actually released by bacteria.
Paul O'Toole is Professor of Genomics in University College Cork. He has spent many years studying the effects of bacteria in the human gut, and in particular, their effects on specific diseases such as Clostridium difficile. One of the latest procedures being undertaken is the transfer of human feces from one person to another, in order to replace beneficial gut bacteria that may have been lost or which the recipient somehow never acquired in the first place.
Yeah, it sounds revolting and it is kind of weird when you hear about it for the first time. It was actually practiced by the Chinese over 5,000 years ago. And basically what it involves is taking a fecal sample, a stool sample from a healthy person, going into the lab and homogenizing it in a liquid, making a kind of a slurry or soup, and then transferring it into the patient with C. diff, usually through a colonoscopy.
So, in English, you're taking poo from one person and you're transplanting that into another person. Now, the average person would say, that's gross, that's disgusting. Why would you do that? You're only going to make them sick.
Okay, so I've been a practicing microbiologist for 30 years and I've been trying to cure ulcers, cure streptococcal throats, and recently I've been trying to cure cancer. And about 4 years ago, we had a patient come to the hospital in Cork. She was a 30-something-year-old mother of three who was having 22 bowel movements per day, and she was seriously ill. And we hadn't done C. diff, FMT, fecal transplants in Cork. So this was the first case. We convened a multidisciplinary team rapidly, and we screened a donor. And this is an important component. You don't just take poo from anybody. You have to take it from somebody who's really, really healthy and safe. So you subject the donor to all of the rigors if they're given a blood transplant, because this is equivalent to giving biological material. And you make sure they don't have AIDS or any nasty infectious disease. Mm-hmm. So we did this for this woman, and she had her first solid bowel movements in weeks, less than a day after getting the fecal transplant. Basically what happened was we re-established her entire intestinal ecosystem instantaneously with the transplantation of bugs from a healthy person, and she was discharged later that week.
So really what you're saying is that these bacteria that are present in your gut, particularly in your lower gut, they're doing a hugely important job for you.
Absolutely.
You're at a dinner party some night.
Yeah.
Someone says, what do you do? Mm. And you say, I work on fecal transplants. They say, does that mean what I think it means? You transfer poo from one person to another. Yeah. How do you answer it?
I try and answer it honestly. And I will quote the examples I've mentioned whereby you're saving lives. Because this is one of the few conditions where a basic scientist like myself, I don't actually physically introduce the poo into the patient. I prepare the inoculum in highly controlled conditions in the hospital. I give to a gastroenterologist. Most people know what a colonoscope is. Most people know somebody's had colon cancer, been scoped. And once you explain to them that you can cure a patient with 95% certainty, I mean, there are very few examples in human medicine where you can cure people with 95% certainty with a single medication. And this is one of them. And it's all based on primary ecosystem biology and rectifying changes in an ecosystem.
And it all goes back to the poo containing these bacteria. So something that we think of as being a waste property, something we think we want away from, we don't want to talk about it, we don't want to see it, we don't want to smell it, it actually contains these magnificent bacteria that help us to stay alive.
The poo is a living ecosystem. The poo is a rainforest. And the person with C. diff infection has an agricultural pasture or a clear-cut forest. And we're reintroducing all the organisms of the rainforest back into the clear-cut rainforest.
So don't think of poo as being bad.
No, poo is a wonderful collection of live bacteria all interacting with each other and with you.
There is much more to poo than meets the eye. Excrement is a far more interesting and useful substance than we give it credit for. An essential and inescapable part of life for every animal. It is much more than simple waste. Indeed, you could say that it is fundamental to the very cycle of life on Earth.